It's 8:06 on this Tuesday morning, May 26. Good morning. 49 degrees currently in Old Town Park City under mostly cloudy skies. We've got 56 degrees in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back on this Tuesday. We've got a chance of scattered showers this morning, maybe a chance of some afternoon thunderstorms developing. The primary threat would be some gusty winds and, of course, some lightning as opposed to heavy rain. But there will be some showers out there, especially for the morning hours. Temperatures will climb into the low 70s for us in Park City. We'll see those highs in the mid to upper 70s in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Wednesday and Thursday, we're going to be in between moisture flows, so that means we're going to be expecting mostly sunny to partly sunny skies and primarily dry conditions. High temperatures will be in the mid 70s for us in Park City for your Wednesday and Thursday. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the upper 70s on Wednesday in the Heber Valley, but jumping into the lower 80s by the time we get towards your Thursday afternoon. Again, expecting lots of sunshine in those areas. As we get towards your Friday, we're going to have that low pressure finally moving our way, and it actually moves over the northern parts of the state. That'll bring in a better chance of seeing some of those isolated to scattered showers and thunderstorms, particularly on your Friday afternoon and Friday evening. High temperatures on Friday will be in the mid to upper 60s in Park City. We'll be in the low 70s for highs in the Heber Valley, so definitely a good bit cooler than where it has been. As we make our way into your Saturday, look for a mixture of sun and clouds. We'll have that, again, that chance of a shower or thunderstorm, especially early in the day. Otherwise, drying out with highs back in the mid-60s in Park City. Highs only around 70 in the Heber Valley. Moving into next week, well, we got sunshine, high pressure builds back in, and it turns warmer with highs back into the low to mid 70s for us in Park City. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the upper 70s to near 80 in the Heber Valley as we go into your Monday and Tuesday of next week. And again, we're looking at partly sunny skies and overall mainly dry conditions expected once we get past your Friday. So overall, a chance of scattered showers today, maybe a pop-up storm this afternoon, then dry until Friday with our next chance of rain. That's a look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Sustainability Manager Emily Quinton. Later on, Max Doyle and Lauren Angarosa with details about their new podcast. And from Summit Community Gardens, we'll be talking with Executive Director and Garden Helen Nadel and Garden Director Jess Collette. Leaders say developing Utah as a nuclear powerhouse will require faster approvals and fewer impediments. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has this update from the Operation Gigawatt Summit in Wasatch County.
Hundreds of people, including many state, federal, and industry leaders, filled the Grand Hyatt Deer Valley Friday to talk about the future of nuclear energy. The summit's name, Operation Gigawatt, was a nod to Utah Governor Spencer Cox's plan to double the state's energy production within 10 years and lead the nation in energy development. Speakers emphasized approving projects faster is key to realizing that vision. Nuclear Regulatory Commission Chair Ho K. Nee told the crowd public opinion toward nuclear energy is shifting.
I still remember Three Mile Island, and I still remember Chernobyl, and I think, you know, as a generation shifting, you know, they don't carry that baggage.
He said his commission will not be an impediment to deploying nuclear power in the U.S. The National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, is one area Nee sees room for working smarter, not harder.
We have been overachieving with NEPA for a very long time. It's like we're assigning ourselves more homework that nobody's ever going to break.
Cox applauded the federal government's current approach to permitting.
When we have to deal with the federal government, it usually means incredible delays. And it kind of, yeah, I had so much hair before I started. and here we are. And so this is refreshing.
Under President Donald Trump's leadership, energy projects are receiving accelerated environmental reviews because of what the administration calls a national energy emergency. The Velvet Wood uranium mine in southeastern Utah received its permits within 11 days last May. The Associated Press reports the process would ordinarily take months or years. Nearby residents have protested the mining plans. In the background of Friday's conference was the Military Installation Development Authority, the state entity whose presence in Utah has grown in recent years, including with the Utah National Guard and Stratos project areas. The Grand Hyatt Deer Valley is itself a MIDA project created to replace a 7-room military lodge at Snow Basin. Salt Lake City resident Jackie Baker sat outside the hotel beginning at 7:30 a.m. with a mountain bike and a sign protesting Maida's growing influence.
My sign says, "Men intentionally defrauding Americans, no Stratus."
She's opposed to Maida's role in the state's push towards nuclear energy and artificial intelligence data centers. Maida is partnering with nuclear power startup General Matter to bring an energy project to Camp Williams in Bluffdale, including potentially enriching uranium. It's also involved in plans to create a nuclear hub in Brigham City. Maida's Stratus project, which will construct a hyperscale data center in Box Elder County, has drawn significant backlash.
I think that we could be smarter about how we are working technology into not only our lives, but our environment. And so I think that it's worth being a body to tell people to slow down a little bit, think a little bit more.
Joel Ferry leads Utah's Department of Natural Resources. He told KPCW, although state permitting might happen faster, the process will still be safe and thorough.
But I can tell you, we as the state of Utah are not cutting corners. We're not trying to just cram something through. We want to do things the right way, and we'll take the time necessary to do things in the right way.
In the case of the Stratus Data Center project, Ferry said that process will include many opportunities for public input. At Friday's conference, Cox signed an agreement to sync Utah's permitting timelines with federal environmental reviews, a move intended to advance energy projects more quickly. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The Summit County Council adopted an updated sustainability and climate goals in January. In the studio to tell us more about that, as well as some other sustainability programs, Summit County Sustainability Program Manager Emily Quinton. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's start there. What are the biggest changes from the county's previous climate strategy?
Sure. So back in January, the County Council adopted Resolution 2026-04, recommitting and expanding to sustainability and climate change action goals. This resolution provided an update and expansion of goals that were last committed to back in 2019 with a resolution. A few key things that this resolution did. One is it did recommit to several core goals around increasing use of renewable energy, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, emphasizing energy efficiency and conservation in the built environment, transportation, some other areas. In terms of changes, this resolution added four new goals. Those included goals around waste, resilience and adaptation, public lands, and water. So while the county certainly has been working on these areas for a very long time, this resolution presented an opportunity to really pull those in under the umbrella of sustainability and climate action into the goals that council has set. And for some of these goals, ultimately, they kind of set a priority. So for example, the waste goal talks about prioritizing waste reduction and diversion, yet ultimately defers to a separate plan, solid waste action plan, for where there are more strategies. And then lastly, the resolution also served to provide an update on a couple areas. So for example, there's long been a goal about transitioning the county's on-road vehicle fleet to be more fuel efficient through hybrid and electric vehicles. We had not met an original goal that had been set for that, 50% by 2022. So we switched that goal around to set a purchasing standard of purchasing hybrid or electric vehicles first with an exemption process. So recommitment, expansion, including some new goals, and updating a few goals here and there.
Yeah, so just kind of refresh our memories. I mean, in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, what's the goal there?
The goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 80% by 2040 for government operations and 80% by 2050 community-wide. And we have baselines for those that they are measured off of. For government operations, we use a baseline from 2016, and for community-wide, we use a baseline from 2014.
Yeah, and in terms of some of the other goals that you've updated with waste reduction, water conservation, I mean, do you have specific targets there?
Yeah, so in the case of waste and water, since these goals are ultimately deferring to separate plans, in the case of the waste goal, this more specific target will be established through an updated solid waste action plan that the county is currently working on. And the group is discussing a goal there around taking action that would extend the life of the landfill by 10 years. And in the case of, say, water, Summit County does have new water use and preservation elements in our general plan. So these are new chapters to the general plan. And while those don't necessarily set a, you know, a strict number reduction target, it does set up the county to sort of embrace the role that we play with water. You know, we're not a water provider ourselves as the county, but there's certainly things that we can do through land use, through collaboration, through bringing stakeholders together to promote water conservation.
Yeah. And I guess what were the driving factors? I mean, why these goals?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, these goals serve to kind of do an update from a 2019 resolution that council had adopted. I think part of it was just time that had passed. So, you know, obviously, local government sustainability and climate action, while, you know, there's a couple decades of experience, is still a fairly new space. It's an emerging practice. So I think, in general, local governments tend to find that it's worth revisiting these goals and updating them and tweaking them. Also, last year, my teammate Megan and I, back in October of 2025, we prepared for and we did a big progress report to council on those 2019 goals. So we brought in data where we had it to report sort of on quantitative progress. We also brought in examples, you know, more kind of qualitative examples, say in terms of new code updates and things like that, to talk a little bit about, kind of how is it going. And so during that presentation and our discussion with council, we acknowledged things that had changed. I think council was interested in taking another look at the goals. And so part of it was time, part of it was sort of reflecting the progress that's been made over the last several years and keeping the goals ambitious over the next few.
Yeah. So how much public input helped shape this updated?
In this case, this was more of kind of a staff review-driven process. So the council's goals really, you know, long before my time here, if you look back, starting as far back as 2010, 2013, the 2015 Climate Action Plan that had extensive public input, these goals have kind of been building on each other over time. And I think in terms of the last couple of resolutions, most recently in January, this is council sort of taking, you know, what we've learned from working on implementing goals that were driven with community input and using staff expertise and council feedback to refine them further.
Yeah, so in terms of the budget, I mean, are there, what funding sources help get you along here?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the goals themselves are fairly high level. So they really set a vision and they help to establish some focus areas for the work both of our sustainability team, but also I think to bolster the work of departments throughout the county. So the goals themselves, the resolution doesn't like set a specific budget number, but the way that we use these goals is on an annual basis. As a sustainability division, when we're doing our annual work plan, we look at, you know, what are some of the key sort of anchor initiatives that we're working on. You know, for example, the Community Clean Energy Program, Utah Renewable Communities, to support the renewable energy goal. And we try to anchor those specific initiatives back to council goals. And then to the extent that those specific initiatives do require budget, we are going to, you know, estimate and seek budget on an annual basis for that work. So, you know, again, drawing from the Community Clean Energy Program, for the most part, our work on that is really staff time. It's our time spent on that. But there will be an expense, you know, later, either this year or early next year, that will incur to notify customers that this program is coming. So in that case, that's a specific number that I can put into the budget estimate of $20,000 for this year.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and certainly the county's environmental goals are admirable. At the same time, we see continued pressure with development and certainly population growth. And I guess, what role do businesses and homeowners need to play for the county to meet its targets? I mean, it's the county that's allowing the new development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the I think one thing that council has been smart about with these goals is that for some of the core goals, such as renewable energy adoption and greenhouse gas emissions reduction, we've set a pretty strict target for our internal government operations. whereas the sort of complementary goal for the community is more about influence and making it possible. So I think we understand that at the end of the day, you know, we can do a lot more to influence our own operations than we can in terms of promoting practices in the community. That being said, we absolutely do need the participation and the commitment from businesses and homeowners and renters in order to be successful towards these goals. And so that's why we have certain kind of outreach, education program, engagement programming, you know, whether that's working with our partners and supporting businesses through the Green Business Program. We also have, you know, it's a fairly like simple thing and maybe not the most impactful, but like we've got energy and water conservation kits that people can check out from the library so that they can, you know, look at their home with a thermal camera, look where the leaks are, and potentially think about weatherizing their home. So, you know, in that case, it's really attempting to make the resources available and the education available to the community. Whereas I think if we're looking at, you know, specifically renovating a county building, we're going to integrate more strict standards into that work.
Okay. Moving on, you mentioned the Community Clean Energy Program through Utah Renewable Communities. Summit County is a participant, so maybe just start by telling us what the program is and how it works.
Sure thing. So the Community Clean Energy Program is a brand new program that will give Utahns in participating communities a new choice to support clean energy right through their Rocky Mountain Power bill. This is a new program that is really brought to you by the Utah Renewable Communities, which is a group of 19 communities, and Rocky Mountain Power. The utility here is a really key partner. What the new program is an opportunity for homes and businesses, by participating right on their Rocky Mountain Power bill, to drive the development of new utility-scale clean energy in the region. This program is different from other options for supporting renewables right now, in that the resources that will be built to serve the program will be new and utility scale. So we're talking really large projects. And the ultimate kind of goal that the communities have is to try to bring on enough clean energy to match the energy use of participants throughout the year. So we have a net 100% goal that we are working on. And we've been working to make this program reality for many, many years now, following legislation that was passed in 2019 by the Utah Legislature, which made this whole effort possible. And just in March of this year, we received approval from the Public Service Commission to move forward with the program.
All right, so the participation you're talking about is financial.
Correct. So The Public Service Commission approved the program in March, and that started a 90-day clock for the 19 local governments involved to take one final step to adopt the program, and that is by adopting an ordinance. And so, for example, the Summit County Council did adopt this ordinance on April 15th, and what that means is that all Rocky Mountain Power customers in unincorporated Summit County will be automatically enrolled in this program, and they will have the option to leave the program if they would like. When the program launches, which is projected to be towards the end of 2026 or early 2027, customers will receive notices that the program is coming. They'll be educated on what it means that they're participating and how they can opt out if they choose. And then the ongoing commitment for customers that do decide to stay in the program, we do have an initial program rate that was set by the Public Service Commission. For residential customers, it's a flat fee of $4 per month. For non-residential customers, it is a per kilowatt hour charge of just over 0.6 cents. And qualifying low-income customers can participate for free.
So for those who have already made the investment and put solar panels on their house, why would they add more? They've already put out thousands.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, it's really important to recognize that folks making an investment, like putting solar on their rooftop, continues to be a really important action that they can take. If folks are thinking about, yeah, you know, I have solar, so why would I participate in this program, or should I participate in this program? So when you put solar on your roof, and there are times when your solar is generating and you're using electricity in your house, you're going to be drawing directly from the energy that you are producing. But there's going to be times throughout the year, you know, even just at night, and throughout the sort of less sunny months of the year, that you're going to be drawing from the grid. So for many folks that have solar, they do still draw a net amount of energy from the grid throughout a year. if they want to make sure that that energy that they're drawing from the grid is supporting clean energy, they might decide to participate in this program. There might be other folks who are producing near all of the energy that they need throughout the year. They may decide that they don't want to participate in this program. You know, I think ultimately it's going to be a choice of each of those customers. And I will just clarify real fast, because actually I remember you asking this question maybe about a year ago, the last time I was on with an update on this program, that the only customers who are not eligible to participate in participating communities are those customers with solar on Schedule 135. So these are going to be folks who installed solar prior to 2017 that have the kind of old net metering program. So it is written into state statute that those are the only customers that don't get put into the program. Otherwise, if you've installed solar, you're on Schedule 136 or 137, it's going to be post-2017. You can participate in the program.
Okay. Real quick, the Utah Renewable Community faced opposition in Kearns just last week. I don't know if you're aware of that. So,
yeah.
I mean, does that threaten the program, or it's just...
Yeah, let me give a little update there. So I mentioned that the Public Service Commission approval, it set off this 90-day clock for all the 19 communities involved to decide whether or not to adopt the final program. Of the 19 communities... so far, we have had 13 communities vote yes to adopt the ordinance. And as you noted, we have had two communities who have voted to not adopt the ordinance. Kearns was one of them, and Cottonwood Heights as well. What we've heard is that Kearns is actually putting out a survey to their community. They are wondering whether or not to reconsider their vote. So they're looking to gather additional community input. And at the end of the day, I mean, you know, as staff that's involved in this, ultimately, my role with the Utah Renewable Communities is there to represent Summit County. I also serve as secretary to the Utah Renewable Community, so I certainly feel very invested in the coalition of communities. But, you know, we always knew that it was going to be the choice of each elected body of these local governments to decide whether or not to stay in.
Okay, and I just want to note, Colville City Council will be voting on that tonight. Oakley City Council will be voting on that tomorrow. One final issue I want to hit real quick. The county's also working on its solid waste action planning, as you mentioned. I guess, what are the biggest waste management challenges that the county faces?
Yeah, so I think we can look at a couple different sources to help us answer that question. First, as part of the solid waste action plan process from about January to March of this year, we did two community surveys, we did some tabling, open house, and we also did some stakeholder meetings. And that helped us to get over 800 responses from the community. And some of the themes that we heard from the community in terms of challenges are confusion about what can or cannot be recycled, and some skepticism over that system, as well as a real strong desire for convenience. So I think that there are challenges just at the community level in terms of, you know, access to information, access to infrastructure and to programs. And then I think another big challenge, we can look back at waste characterization studies that have been done in the community. So this is looking at the waste coming into the landfill and seeing what makes up that waste. And we know that there's a lot of pretty easily divertible materials coming into the landfill, including food waste and including cardboard. So I think a challenge is we've got materials that don't need to be going into the landfill, but they are. And we've got folks that are needing a little bit more information or clarification on how to keep those materials out of the landfill. And so that's part of what the Solid Waste Action Plan will hopefully try to address.
Okay. And what changes could residents notice first, I suppose, as this action plan gets rolling?
Yeah, so we have not yet finalized the actual strategies that the county will implement. That's part of what we're working on right now. But we do have a draft list of strategies. So for example, we're hoping to pursue doing a feasibility study for what it would look like for the county to set up, say, a composting facility that is county run and county owned. In the meantime, while we work on some of those, you know, more kind of medium term strategies, the county is rolling out a couple of new programs this year that residents can expect to see. So two key new programs. The first is that we're rolling out new remote recycling drop off sites. So this is going to hopefully respond to the desire for more convenience. We did poll community members about what convenience means, and neighborhood drop-off sites was a popular choice. So there will be more information coming as those roll out over the summer. The county is also rolling out a new web and mobile app called Recycle Coach. So in addition to it being a place for recycling schedules to be posted, the Recycle Coach app has a really neat feature of a like where does it go search function. So people will be able to search material by material, and it can will tell them what bin to go into. And a great thing about this web and mobile app is that it could be spread across multiple different websites in the community so that people are ultimately coming and they're finding the exact same information.
Okay. Out of time, anything else you wanted to mention, though?
I guess, you know, as the Solid Waste Action Plan process is moving forward, if folks have questions about that, they can visit summitcounty.info/actionplan for more information on the remote collection sites and the Recycle Coach app.
All right. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Emily Quinton, again, is Summit County Sustainability Manager. A new podcast is being produced by longtime Park City resident Max Doylney and former mental health specialist Laura Angerosa. The podcast titled Ski In, Ski Out. They both join me now in studio. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having us.
I guess first, how did the two of you, coming from very different professional backgrounds here, decide to partner?
Well, let's first we got to correct the record. The podcast is called Ski In, Sell Out.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a little play on our feeling about some of the topics that we talk about in the podcast. But
You know, Max and I have been friends forever. My favorite story about our relationship is that I used to work for him at the corner store my first season in town in 2004. So we've stayed connected the whole time, and I don't know, Max is good at convincing people that things are a good idea.
So I guess what sparked the idea then for the podcast? I mean, what was the conversation?
Okay, well, so basically Lauren came over from the mental health world to get into the real estate industry with me. A few years ago, I was kind of working my way through getting off council and what am I going to do next? And so I decided to take my last job in Park City, which is to be a residential real estate agent. At the time, I was consulting commercially and doing a bunch of different things that people do after they get done with a stint on council or done with, you know, a long career of something else. And I convinced Lauren that I needed a partner because real estate can be all in, and we know that we need some time off, so teams seem to do the best at that. And so I convinced her to come over to the real estate industry, and she suggested, what do you think about a podcast? And I was like, man, I don't know if people want to listen to our coffee conversation, but we decided to give it a go, and it's actually kind of got some pretty good response so far.
Yeah, so are you guys doing this for money or for fun? Or, I mean, are there sponsorships involved?
Not yet.
I don't think there's enough money in podcasting to live in Park City.
So the title, as you mentioned, Ski and Sell Out, is interesting. I mean, what does selling out mean in the context of Park City?
Oh, that's a great question.
That is a good question. We interviewed my cousin Jake Doyle, and he's the broker over at View Christie's, and we work there at View Christie's, when we first came up with that name. And
He didn't like it.
He was a little offended. And honestly, I think that's kind of part of it. I grew up in Park City. One of my longest and oldest friends used to say, you know you've failed at life when you become a real estate agent in Park City, and I'm wearing that jersey. And it was just sort of a look in the mirror and really own the thing that you're doing and talk about it.
Yeah. You've interviewed some longtime locals, business leaders, real estate professionals. I guess, is there a common theme that keeps emerging?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, I will say the reason we kind of started the podcast is because we kept having this conversation that had a theme. And it has carried out throughout the podcast where we're talking a lot about why people choose to live in Park City, how they get here, why they chose to come here from maybe historical family roots in different parts of the country, and then what keeps people here. And also, even, you know, Max and I have a lot of conversation between the two of us around what it takes to stay here. And it's an expensive life, it's an expensive town, but we can be creative in how we stick around. And I think a lot of people are talking about their commitment and their choice to stay in this community because of the reason that they chose to be here.
Yeah, so has Park City kind of reached that tipping point, though, in terms of affordability?
Oh, God. Yeah, it reached that a long time ago. But, you know, what's interesting is the region hasn't. There's, you know, obviously so much growth going on around here. And you can either love that or hate it, but in my entire life, I've never had a moment where people weren't complaining about growth. The reality is sometimes you gotta close your eyes and just accept the way the world is, and we are gonna grow. And so growing responsibly is really important. We've obviously dealt with that in a variety of ways. Emily was on earlier talking about different ways that we can responsibly grow. So, you know, look, it's coming. What we have found, though, on the podcast is that people still come here for the same reasons that, say, my parents or maybe you moved here and Dar moved here, which is lifestyle, convenience, weather, people. Just had a coffee over at Pink Elephant this morning, and the girl who's working there said to me, she's just so shocked at how nice people are. And I think that it's interesting when we live in this bubble, we're used to an elevated sort of lifestyle. Talking to people who chose to move here, who work really hard to get here, or chose to move here after they've been very successful, that's really interesting. And then going back in time, talking to people of my dad's generation who have been here for a long time, they moved here for the same reasons and they stay here for the same reasons. And I think that that's a piece that binds us. But what's unique is everybody has their own story. It's so cool.
Yeah. So is the podcast about real estate, or is real estate just kind of the lens into a bigger conversation about community and culture?
I think the podcast started, I guess, you know, generally about real estate because I had a lot of questions and I had a lot of judgments, and Max and I spent a lot of time talking about it, and then I said I think we should talk to other people besides each other. But it has evolved. It's been a really fun process to watch the evolution of how we got into it and the conversations that we were having when we were really focused on the real estate part. The thread is still there. It's the people in this community and the fabric that feels really important.
Yeah. Max, what was it like in interviewing your dad about early Park City history?
You know, I think people of that generation, they never run out of stories about this town or how they got here. There's unique little elements. Something came up. I'm sure he told me the story before, but he and Bill Coleman went on they were doing something for the city, and they were driving to Colorado and back, and on their way back they bumped into somebody who was, it looked like their house was burning down, or their field in front of their house was burning. And, you know, my dad's version of it, and I think we'll try and have Bill on, or maybe it was Jess Reed, I can't remember, one of these guys. Anyway, they jumped out, and apparently they saved this house, right? They were firefighters for a moment. The glorification of those stories is really fun. And you never quite get enough. And we've got feedback on that particular episode where people are like, God, that is, it's so interesting. It's so fun to know new things about Park City through the people who live here.
Yeah. It's almost an oral history going on too. Huh?
It is. I mean, I think that has been a part of it too for us. And I love that historical part. And I think that I've always been a member of the Park City Museum, and I think it's fun to have a little snapshot of a preservation of those stories that I'm not sure we have a great way of passing down.
Yeah. Any guest or episode, Lauren, that's kind of surprised you?
You know, one of my favorites, before we even started the podcast, I said to Max, we have to have your dad on. But I think one of the ones that I love is our friend Andy Cordray was on, and he is a guy who I can like pull back into my history in Park City, and he worked the door at O'Shucks when I was getting into the bars underage, and it's just fun to kind of pull that through to real time right now and understand that part of my story and his story and our story together. It was great.
Yeah. So what are some of the other topics that you hope to kind of, you know, tackle on the podcast?
You know, actually, we don't produce it that much. We actually look at the person, right? We want to talk to people. Lauren does a really good job of asking people where they were born, where they were raised, and that invariably gets people into a real personal place, and then they tell us their story. Our most recent podcast, I met a guy at a showing, right? So there's a real estate tie. We were walking through some product, and we hit it off, started having coffee, and before I know it, I learned that this dude produced music for Jay-Z and Sean Paul back in the 90s and late 90s, early 2000s. 9/11 happened. He's in New York. He chooses to jump into the military. He ends up being a Marine flying Harrier jets off of aircraft carriers into Afghanistan and Iraq. And now he flies long-haul flights for United. And you just never know who you're having coffee with or who's standing next to you. And this town has so many of those stories. Each individual in it has a story about their life. And I think that that's more interesting than how do you buy and sell real estate? How do you... None of that stuff is really all that unique, but we all have a unique story within it, and we've all had to find different ways to stay here.
So I don't know if there's a way to track, but do you have any idea who the podcast is resonating with? I mean, is it the long timers? Is it the locals, younger professionals?
Yeah, I don't know that we have a way to track that specific. We have, Max kind of looks at the numbers sometimes to see how many people we have listening, and it always kind of surprises us. In the beginning, our running joke was that nobody's listening, but my husband gave us feedback. We had to stop saying that. I think it's kind of hitting a lot of them. I mean, we have a good friend in town who just kind of stumbled upon it. He grew up here, and he couldn't say nicer things about it. And I think the historical piece is resonating for somebody like that. And then I have friends who are, you know, 1 or 2 years into living into town, and they have really enjoyed listening because it gives them this view on this town that they've chosen to live in that they probably wouldn't get. So I think, well, and then there's my dad who listens to it to go to bed.
Okay. And I guess who should we look forward to having on the program?
Well, some of our past, you know, we had Mayor Dickey on. We're actually going to do a stretch where we interview the spouses of real estate agents because they have a lot of stories about the time it takes to get these to do this job, right? Sometimes you get phone calls in really odd hours. And anyway, so we thought that they might tell a more honest story because real estate agents tend to try and make everything look rosy. As if you follow anybody, any real estate agent on Instagram, you'll see that this was a great winter. But their spouse tells a different story. They're in houses cleaning them up in the middle of the night to try and make sure that they look good for the next day. And you know, one of the themes early was that real estate industry is a lot of work, but we always want to tease out whether it's really hard work or if it's just a lot, with the difficulty being the impact on your life. I don't know about hard. I think we had some things on council that came across where I felt like my brain just couldn't quite process all the bits and pieces and the moving parts. Real estate doesn't quite feel that dynamic, but it is interesting. No two deals are the same. And that part does lend itself to a lot of work. So this debate about a lot of work versus hard work has kind of been part of the theme. But that's not answering who's coming on. We kind of want everybody, whoever wants to come on.
I think my goal for the next handful of months is to make sure that we get some good, like Jim Doyle-ney, some good folks that have been in town for a long time that can kind of talk about Park City the way it was and how they experience it now.
Yes. Yeah. What's the turnaround time on that? You say you just let it roll, you don't do a lot of editing?
No.
We can get one ready in about 15 to 20 minutes after the episode. We don't edit at all. We try and keep it real raw. And then we try to publish on, you know, the first 2-3 days of each week. So we have 26 episodes right now. And we should have another one coming out here in the probably today. And then we have 2 or 3 lined up. And, mm-hmm. and then we might do our spouses just to see how they feel about the spouse month.
Okay, Ski and Sail Out. I'm guessing you can get it wherever you get your podcast.
Yep, wherever you find them.
Yep, skiandsailout.com.
Okay.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. We've been talking with podcasters Max Doyle-ney and Lauren Angerosa. On the studio now with an update from Summit Community Gardens and Eats, I have Executive Director Helen Nadel along with Garden Director Jess Collette. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Great. So, Helen, why don't you start just by telling us a little bit about the mission of Summit Community Gardens and Eats?
Sure. Well, thank you so much, Leslie. It's great to be here and great to be here with Jess. The mission of Summit Community Gardens is really all about building community through food. So we are about learning, gathering, and growing both in schools and in the community garden that we steward. And I'll just say the community garden is really a unique space. It is ideal for connecting people to how food grows. It's 1.5 acres, and it's made up of concentric circles. So in the center of the garden is a, you know, is a circle with that's divided into four quadrants, and that's where our staff is growing food. There are neat rows filled with seasonal food. And the idea here is that it's really a demonstration garden. So our experts, Jess, Colette, who's with me now, as well as our seasonal team, Luce and Roz, are growing the food to, and sort of showing community members how to grow food, what grows in our, you know, in our climate. And they are, obviously, they're also, they're growing for the food pharmacy. But that area is, it's like I said, very, very neat, very orderly. And then surrounding that are the 130 community garden plots. And that is just this vibrant riot of fun things that individuals get to decide what they are growing. And I think that that connection of people getting to grow what they want, but also everybody being able to come to the community garden, not just plot runners. It's open to everyone. And folks can walk through and see both kind of that, the very neat rows, and then the sort of vibrant expanse of what other people are growing. And it's just, it's a really cool space, and it's open to all.
Yeah, so of the 130 plots, do you have any still available for rent?
We actually, you know, I'm going to turn that over to Jess, I think, to answer.
We actually do not. We are fully rented out for the season. We do have a wait list, though, if folks are interested in getting on that on our website. Occasionally people move or need to return their plots throughout the season, so we do have a wait list if folks are interested.
Okay, so for those that haven't been out to kind of tend their garden at this point, I know that you kind of watch that as well, and then give them notice, and then those would be available if they don't...
Yeah, potentially a little bit later on, yeah.
Okay, so it's been pretty nice weather. I mean, when's a safe time to put your starts in the ground?
Right now is a great time to plant all of your root vegetables and greens and these cold-tolerant herbs like cilantro and dill and parsley. But I'm still holding off on those frost-sensitive plants, so tomatoes, peppers, squash, all those summer veggies, just a little bit longer, probably more around mid-June. The nights are still going to get colder, even though they're kind of nice right now. I just know that we're going to have more frosty nights. So,
yeah, so if you do have the frost cloth, will that save those cucumbers and squash?
It can to an extent. So it's really important to just be looking at the forecast at least 10 days out. The frost cover will help provide about 4 to 5 degrees of protection. So it can dip below kind of that like frosty threshold by 4 to 5 degrees if you have frost cloth. But anything stronger than that, the frost cloth won't truly protect them fully.
Mm-hmm. And what I've noticed in the garden is that tomatoes do fabulously, whereas they don't do great at my house. I mean, I guess just because of that full sun, yeah?
Yeah, tomatoes and all the summer veggies need about 8 hours of sun per day minimum. So they definitely love the full sun of the garden.
Okay, so you're there pretty much every day and also available to help gardeners?
yeah, I'm always happy to walk over to people's plots and provide specific advice, show what we're working on. Yeah, I love it. I'm there most days. Yeah,
and I think, we do have some garden team member there every day. So Jess works, you know, 5 days a week, but Tuesday through Saturday. Mm-hmm. But our AmeriCorps volunteer, who's really great, is working Monday through Thursday. So there's always somebody there, I think, except on Sundays, right?
Yeah.
And I guess... Yeah, I think the other thing I just wanted to share is obviously, like Jess has just pointed out, how she's available to plot renters, but also our team is there to kind of just help people who are visiting to just sort of show them where the snacking garden is or, you know, help them understand a little bit more about the climate and what's growing and why we might have certain crops growing and why we might not have others. And also, of course, talk about the food pharmacy, right? All of the food in the center of the garden grown by our team goes to the, you know, patients at the People's Health Clinic.
When will that program kind of pick up, that food pharmacy? I mean, it's still very early, right?
Yeah, so probably around mid-June is when we'll start harvesting from the garden for that program, though it does continue year-round just with grocery store produce that we purchase during the off season. But we'll start harvesting for it in mid-June.
So is that part of the EATS mission or the Gardens mission?
Yeah, I mean, I think both Summit Community Gardens and EATS, you know, when they were separate organizations, did have food access programming. EATS had the Fruit to Schools program, which continues to this day with about 7,000 pounds of fresh fruit delivered every school year. And then the community garden also had its own way of kind of trying to, you know, grow food for folks who we're experiencing food insecurity. We are a completely merged organization, so there's not a separate mission right now. It's a joint mission, and we really are all about building community through food. And this is, you know, the food access work that we do is a part of that.
Okay, let's move on, talk a little about some of the other things that you've got going on. You've listed the dinners in the gardens dates.
Yes, I do. And I, what I'll just say is I'd love to talk about some of that. And I was hoping that Jess could also share a few words about the idea of a third space in the garden. But first, let me just let everybody know that the Dinners in the Garden program is open. We've been accepting registrations from members of the public for a couple weeks now. And our final garden dinner was just announced. So that is that Tupelo is going to be joining us. That was listed as a mystery dinner. We still have a bunch of people who have purchased tickets for that. But that is, we can say now that that dinner on August 6th is Tupelo. We also have a dinner with Hill's Kitchen on July 9th, Shabu on August 20th, and then our fabulous Pie and Beer Night on July 24th, which is the you know, our celebration of Pioneer Day. And I'll just put a shout out and thank you to Auntie M's for, again, having some great pie for us there. I will mention that the Twisted Fern and Loma dinner, the first dinner in June, is already sold out. We have a long wait list for that. So I would just say, you know, purchase those tickets early, folks. We've got some really fabulous restaurant partners who are, you know, again, you know, providing a tremendous service to us in the garden by helping to host these dinners and raise money for the food pharmacy.
Okay. What's the third space, Jess? In the garden.
So a third space is a social space that's separate from the two usual social environments of home, which is the first place, and workplace as the second place. So it's really just a place where you can meet and be around other people outside of, you know, those two places where most people spend most of their time. And I feel like examples of those are like fitness classes, cafes, churches, libraries, bars, etc. But it's really hard to find ones that don't require spending money or other commitments or being part of an existing community that are public and open to everyone. And so I think that the garden is a really important space for that. Anyone can go there and enjoy kind of the joys of being outdoors, the joys of moving your body, being around other people, learning about growing. It's just a really cool space. And the garden is open all the time to the public. It is never closed. There's a gathering space where people can sit in the shade and bring a lunch, eat a picnic, harvest from our snack and garden, talk to myself or Luce or any of the other plot holders and hear about what they're growing and tips on how to grow it. So yeah, I just really like that you can go there for free, learn about gardening, be outside, be in this really beautiful environment. We have an incredible view from the garden. But yeah,
we are surrounded by mountains. It's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And I'll just put a plug in again for the snacking garden, something mm-hmm. that we started last year, which is just pretty magical. We will probably, I'm trying to think of when things will first be available to harvest from there. Probably in, I'm going to say July, early July.
Yeah. Late June, early July, we'll start having some radishes and greens and peas, hopefully.
There's a special spot in the garden. We really wanted people to be able to just come in and have that direct connection, just be able to harvest something and taste it right there. That is the magic of growing food.
Okay, yeah. Real quick, you've got some camp starting once school's out?
Yeah, we have camp starting on June 8th is the first day of camp. I will say we have a lot of camps, a couple of camps are almost sold out. We do have a lot of scholarship spaces, though. So becas disponibles. We've got scholarships available for camp, and really would encourage people to go on the website, talk to people they know who may be interested. But we definitely still have space both for you know, families who can afford the fee and also families who might need some help. So please check us out. It's pretty cool, as we've been talking about, the magical space. That's where kids spend their time this summer. It's really amazing.
Okay, and then you're also offering some community classes. So these, for gardeners, Jess?
Yeah, so we have both some gardening-related classes and then some other ones that are located in the garden. So I'll be teaching a monthly series of classes around, like, organic pest management, compost tea. We're going to do a fun garden tour, garlic planting, all of that. And so those are welcome to any community member to sign up for. It's not just for plot holders. This knowledge can be applied to your own growing space as well. And then we're also going to have free family yoga in the garden. We've got a watercolor class coming up and then some more other community classes.
Yeah, and I really just want to put a quick plug out for supporting the local food system. Right now, this week, we've got the PC Farmers Market is opening tomorrow from 11 to 5 at PCMR. We've got Copper Moose Farm opening. They're going to be open on Thursday. Their hours this week, they're open 12 to 6 Thursdays, 9 to 5 on Saturdays. And also just want to give a shout out to Moonshadow Farm. They're doing farm walk and talks. The first one is Saturday, June 27th from 6 to 7:30. Walk the land together, see where all that food is grown, and then the folks who there'll be hors d'oeuvres there for all the people who purchase their food. Yeah, the restaurants who purchase their food will be providing delicious snacks.
Okay, all that information online, summitcommunitygardens.org.
Yes.
Okay, Jess, Helen, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.